Chris Johnson also for six with Vickery. He's on the DL with a spider bite, but I think that happened after the bid.
Is he really?
Yeah.
Oh God.
I've heard of snake bit, but not spider bit.
Episode 65 of Flags Fly Forever, a baseball prospectus fantasy podcast. I am your host, Brett Sayer, and with me, as always, is Mike Gianella and George Bissell. How are you guys doing on this this Wednesday evening of much baseball?
Pretty good. Just enjoying the games. This is a rare Wednesday where I had to go to the office, so I missed the day games, but I'm making up for it tonight.
I'm very much enjoying Daniel Norris doing Daniel Norris things. Well, it's been a fun night in that regard.
Well, you must have missed the third or the fourth inning. I think it was the third.
I haven't seen the whole thing. I just know the home runs. Okay. Wait, what happened?
It's now 7-3.
Oh no.
Fowler and Brian homered.
Well, it was fun for a while.
Yeah. Well, if you play a league with wins, you're still going to get the win. I mean, unless the Cubs go nuts, which they have been doing.
Yeah, I wouldn't rule that one out.
I think the wind's blowing out, too.
Yeah, that I read. It has to be blowing out if Castellanos has hit two home runs already.
Oh, Norris homered.
Yeah, that was what I was talking about.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the pitching.
Norris might have more power than Castellanos.
He had that home run in BP where he broke the scoreboard. And then he goes out and hits one in his first career at bat. I mean, that's boss status right there.
Did you see his tweet?
Yeah. He's like, sorry. Like,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was like, Dan, never apologize, okay? You're something else. I mean, between the van and this stuff, like that guy should be in the National League. I'm sorry. He should be.
He seems like a fun guy. But we'll jump right into our normal format this week. I know last week we deviated from that, and we'll probably do that again at some point because that was fun, but not this episode. So you can read all of us at baseballprospectus.com. You can find us on Twitter. I am at Dynasty Guru. Mike is at Mike Gianella. That's G-I-A-N-E-L-L-A. And George is at George Bissell. It's two S's and two L's. Rate and view us on iTunes. Email us, flexflyforeverbaseballprospectus.com. Now we're going to do our usual expert fab bidding thing. So as I always do, I'm going to kick it to Mike. So, Mike?
Let's start with the mixed. There's probably more to talk about in the National League, but you know, let's go over to labor. We are out of fab, as everybody knows, so we haven't bid on anybody, and we're looking to make a trade, but we haven't. I don't know about you, Brett. I haven't heard from anybody. Have you?
No. It seems pretty quiet right now.
Well,
the deadline's not for another like week and a half, I think. So
I think it's the 31st. Actually, it's a little bit later than the 31st in that league. So, yeah, we've got about 2 weeks. We're looking to kind of fine-tune some stuff in that league and try to add, like, a better starter than, like, Jared Weaver or Anthony DeSclafani for our sixth starter, which they're minor things. If we get them done, that's great. If we don't get them done, whatever. So the fab was pretty light. Teams are running out of money. There were five players who were purchased over $1 total, and of those bids, two of them were contested. So the first of those was Jackie Bradley Jr. Coming off of, well, I don't want to say historic weekend, but a historic game. I think I saw, you know, in the DFS parlance everybody's talking about today, he had the largest game like in DFS in the last like 2 or 3 years or since DFS has been a thing. You know, my feeling about Bradley is, you know, he's one of those pickups in a deeper mix. He's fine. You know, he is what he is. I think he could turn a corner, but I think he's always one of those players who could turn a corner. He could also go back to, you know, kind of being more of a glove guy as opposed to a bat. I don't really have a lot of strong feelings about him. I don't know, Brett, George, you know, how you guys feel. You're more the dynasty guys, and you've probably tracked him for a lot longer than I have.
Yeah, I'll be curious to hear what George thinks, because he's up there and follows the Red Sox, I think, more closely than I do. But I'm not a fan. I think he's good enough to play in AL only and deep mix leagues. If not now, then I think he will be at some point. But I don't think he's ever going to get beyond that. I just don't think he's all that interesting in fantasy.
I think the phrase everyone wants to use is that Jackie Bradley Jr. has finally figured it out. And I don't really think that's the case. He's still going to be a guy who struggles to hit for any kind of an average. The issue for him has been strikeouts, and I think plate approach in general, it just hasn't been great. And I sort of see his ceiling in terms of the type of guy he is like a poor man's Kevin Kiermaier. Like, that's probably his best case, and Kiermaier's got more power than Bradley does. So I don't think he gives you enough in any one single category to really be relevant. And he's not a great base stealer. He just kind of doesn't do a whole lot. It's like Anthony Ghost, but without stolen bases. Like, that's kind of what I see Bradley as. His values is all in the defense, and that means nothing in fantasy.
So is he just an AL-only guy to you then?
Yeah, I mean, right now, it's obviously a great stretch, and we'll see what he does, but pretty much in the last 2 years, he's looked nothing like what he's looked like the last 2 weeks. So I think that's the outlier. I don't want to read too much in just this small handful of at-bats. You got to look at the bigger picture with Bradley right now.
Yeah, and you know what I'd point out from a roto or a fantasy standpoint, you're talking about a 15-team mixed league with six-man reserves. This is really a matter of Bradley's one of the best guys out there. You know, I actually made the argument in my column that the bid's a little bit low. If you're in Steve Gardner's position, he's slipped lately. You know, we talked about this a few episodes ago. He traded Giancarlo. You know, he's down to fifth place now. You know, you kind of roll the dice on a guy like Bradley. And if he's, you know, has a weird hot streak for the next 2 or 3 weeks, great. If he doesn't, you know, Steve's in a position where there's not really anyone better out there anyway. So I agree with both of you. You know, it's thumbs down on Bradley for me long term. But in, you know, labor, I think it's fine what Steve did.
Yeah, in a league that deep, I mean, you got to pick him up. I mean, this is, yeah, he's hitting, but I don't know how long that continues. That's the issue with Bradley.
Yeah, and then the other guy who was contested, and, you know, we can certainly talk about some of these other players if you want. You know, I know your boyfriend, Martin Perez, was taking Brett, so we can talk about him if you want. But the other guy who was contested was Raisel Iglesias. He went for three also to Steve. My take on Iglesias is I like the play down the stretch for the strikeouts. The two kind of knocks against him this week, he's a two-start pitcher, but, you know, it's kind of a rough road. And, you know, the other thing is the Reds, you know, because of the imbalanced schedule, get a lot of Central down the stretch, which means you get a lot of Cubs, you get a lot of Pirates, you get a lot of Cardinals. They're the three best teams in the National League by record and probably in reality. So it's not a terrible play, but if you're looking for wins, you know, if you're looking for matchups, I don't think he's the best play. Again, based on the format, I think he's fine. I also like him better long term than I think I like him for the rest of the season.
I'm actually big on Iglesias. I really like what he's done since rejoining that rotation. If you look at since the start of the month in four starts, he's got an ERA right around 2. He's allowed 6 runs total, 22 strikeouts to just 5 walks. He's got like a funky delivery, and I think that helped him out. You know, last night against Kansas City, they'd never seen him before, so I think that worked to his advantage with the 7 shutout innings. But you're right, it's a good point about the matchups. But I think in a league of this size, that a guy like him's still available, that's a nice pickup there.
I was going to say I really like Iglesias' stuff, and it's not that his stuff has gotten any better over the course of the season. I think his His command has gotten a little bit better, but what's most important is that he's getting a little bit more stretched out. I mean, he's a guy who really was not very stretched out at the beginning of the season when he started in the rotation, and now I think he seems a little bit more comfortable as he goes deep into games. And you know, the last couple of times he's pitched, he's thrown more innings. He's had a couple of one seven inning outing sprinkled in, but he's gone at least six and five straight starts, and that's really a big deal. You know, since he's come back up from AAA, he's got a 3.67 ERA. He's got almost a strikeout an inning. He's still giving up a couple home runs, but he's been really solid. I think he's going to be a really interesting. He's an interesting guy down the stretch, but I think he's going to be a really interesting kind of cheap guy for 2016, because he's the type of guy who I think could see a real step forward in having a regular, you know, a full off season in the U.S. to really get his bearing straight. I mean, he did spend the offseason in the U.S. last year, but he had signed the contract, and it was not exactly smooth sailing. He was getting used to a lot of things. So he's definitely got the repertoire, and the other things seem to be falling into place.
Is there anyone else here on this list that you guys wanted to discuss? It's a, like I said, it's a really short group this week.
Well, we should probably. I mean, Kike Hernandez is one of the first guys that got taken. He was taken for $4. His mixed league value pretty much just goes away with the Outley trade, right?
Yeah, and I thought even before the trade, you know, he's playing a little bit, and you know, Kendrick's out, but I wasn't really a big fan anyway. He's kind of a guy who moves things and runs batted in, good lineup, but yeah, I would think he goes kind of to a super sub status now at best, which in a deeper mix, no, and an NL only, that's fine.
Yep. Yeah, nobody needs to hear me talk about Martin Perez anymore. So I'll pass.
We can do a whole separate podcast for that if we like.
Very true.
So
should we talk about Derek Dietrich at all? Because he's been really, really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you guys can go first, and then I'll, you know, and we'll kind of flip things here. You guys can go first, and I'll chime in if I have anything to add.
Okay, Dietrich is one of these kind of. It's not really hidden anymore because his hot streak is really extended, but he has been really, really good this year, he's been really solid, especially over the past 2 months. I'm just looking at his stats since the 1st of July. Since the 1st of July, he's hitting .276 with an almost .400 on base and .500 slugging. It's really impressive. He's got multi-position eligibility in most leagues. I'm actually looking to see how many games he's played at each position right now. He's played 22 games at third, 19 games in the outfield, and then he carried over second base eligibility from last year. So he should be second, third, and outfield in pretty much every league, and he's quietly been possibly the Marlins' best hitter next to Giancarlo Stanton, even including D. Gordon.
That's kind of sad, but you know, it's
yeah. He's got a 143 OPS plus on the season, full season.
I wouldn't have, you know, if you asked me to guess that, I would have probably said like 126. I wouldn't have realized it was that high.
Yeah, he just keeps hitting. He's sort of he's got 8 home runs in 53 games. He's not running, but that's not a part of his game. He looks like he's developing into a guy who, you know, is stronger in OBP leagues because he really does take a walk, But he could really be a 260, 20 homer player. He'll lose his second base eligibility after this year, but that's valuable in most formats these days.
Let me ask you, Brett, if you're in a dynasty league, who would you rather have, Derek Dietrich or Marcell Ozuna?
Ozuna.
Okay.
I still am a big Ozuna fan.
But this year has been like the worst possible scenario.
And it's really, really close between the two. But I prefer Dietrich for the rest of this year. I still believe that Ozuna is a pretty... I don't know what happened to his power earlier in the season, and who knows what the Marlins are doing to him, but I still think he's a 25-homer bat with a reasonable batting average. In an on-base league, I might take Dietrich.
Yeah, it's a lot closer now than it was a couple months ago, though.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I think Dietrich's intriguing, and, you know, he's at the point where in deeper mix he should be owned. You know, our worst outfielder before he went down with an injury is Aaron Hicks, who's doing quite well, so we don't really have the need. But, you know, if you have a spot that's kind of dead or weak, I think Dietrich's a fine addition.
Yeah, that was I think that was really the only guy I wanted to talk about.
Did you have anyone, or did you want to shift over to the NL and tout NL in the eventual discussion of your boyfriend there?
No, we touched on Iglesias. He was the big guy for me. That I like there in mix. So let's move to the NL.
I want to kind of, you know, hopefully you listen to this and read the column and the FAB column, and, you know, if you don't, you should, because the two augment each other. I want to talk a little bit about strategy. So, you know, things are looking a little bit worse for me than they did entering the week, and definitely a couple weeks ago. As I'm, you know, talking to you, I am all of 2 points up on Tristan Cockcroft of ESPN, who, you know, I made the What About Bob joke. You know, he never goes away. You know, he's Bill Murray in that movie. So Tristan is in the position, or has been in the position most years. He's very strong in ERA and WHIP. He needs wins. He could get a point in strikeouts, but I think really the play for him in the pitching side is wins. So he made a very aggressive bid on Charlie Morton. He bid 35. It was moved down to 27 with Vickery. That was about half of his remaining FAB. He wasn't in play for any of the deadline guys in Jose Reyes, you know, Cespedes or Brandon Moss. So he kind of wielded, I think he had the second highest amount of FAB coming in. He kind of wielded the hammer for a pitcher that Brett and I talked about offline. We don't really love Morton, and Brett kind of advised me against bidding on him, which I think was solid. But in Tristan's position, you know, pushing for the wins where all he really has to lose in ERA and WHIP might be 2 points total, barring a disaster, for a possible four-point gain in wins is a really good move. Whereas for me, where I have more risk in ERA and WHIP, bidding, going after Morton is not really a good play. So we're at that point of the year, and especially like tout, where it's so tightly contested, where it's not so much the player as the position you're in categorically, and, you know, what you can do to move up. And, you know, a savvy owner like Tristan is definitely like looking at all of that and definitely making those plays.
Yeah. The, you know, regardless of what you think of Morton, you know, and I think the way you laid it out in the article, is really great, is that, you know, you could have, we're really getting to the point of the season where, we talk about this for trades, but it creeps into free agency as well, where you could have two players on the waiver wire, and you're pretty confident that one is a more valuable player than the other, but the other becomes a better fit for your team, and even within the same position. So it's you know, it's knowing which players are bigger ratio risks, knowing. At this point, even as detailed as knowing a guy's opponent's schedule for the rest of the season, I mean, we're getting to the second half of August. You can look up a pitcher's schedule for the rest of the year, and, you know, you can pretty much tell who he's going to be facing, yeah, barring, you know, a rain delay or two. But it all goes into the thought process, and it's something that everyone should be taking a look at before they make trades.
The other thing interesting about Tristan's team, you know, Tristan and I have talked about this via direct message on Twitter, and I'm not, you know, giving any secrets away that he wouldn't want me to. there's a lot of pitchers that are going to be, you know, shut down or have their innings capped and have starts skipped. Tristan Staff, if you look at it closely, he doesn't have any pitchers like that. He has pitchers who, barring injury or barring rainout, should, you know, pitch their way through. So he's definitely planning ahead, and he's definitely looking at all of those angles. And, you know, if you're in a competitive league, you know, and, you know, a lot of home leagues are competitive, you know, regardless of the quality, at least in my experience, you have owners like that who are doing that. And, you know, it's funny, we talked before we went online with the show. I have a grid that I keep for Tout Wars, and I keep this for all the leagues where it's competitive and close, where I look at all the starters, and I'm like, okay, this guy has, you know, this guy pitching here, this guy has this guy pitching here, the free agents are pitching here. To your point, Brett, I'm already looking, like, you know, I'm not looking at the end of the season, but I'm already looking like 2 weeks ahead to try to figure out, you know, where some of these guys are going to go and how I should use my FAP.
Every week matters.
Yeah, especially in a race like this.
What?
I was going to say, especially in a race like this where, you know, it's a 2-point, well, now it's 2.5-point gap as I hit refresh, you know, as opposed to, like, say, a 15-point gap.
Every start matters, and every piece of information that you can gather is a good piece of information.
Yep.
I'm interested, Mike. Would you sort of go the opposite way and try and maybe conserve your ratios and hope that, well, maybe Tristan's strategy backfires, or how are you playing that?
Well,
that's
a really good segue into what I decided to do. So I kind of looked at the pitchers out there, and besides Morton, who I didn't bid on, there was Adam Conley, who I didn't want any part of, and there were some Rockies pitchers who I didn't want any part of, including Chris Russon, who, you know, had a nice start against San Diego, but you don't really want to play with lightning there. So I did go the reliever route. I'm not going all relievers. I'm running five starters out there, but I sat Jorge De La Rosa, who the last I looked was pitching really well tonight, but it's a home start. And I kind of went for relievers who have been pitching multiple innings, rubber arms. And I bid on Justin Grimm and Pedro Baez and didn't get either one. But then I did wind up with Carlos Villanueva and Clayton Richard. And the play is, I'm trying to take relievers who are pitching multiple innings, who are on solid teams, whose managers have been putting them in opportunities to win in tight games. So I'm mining the ratios a little bit, but I'm also looking kind of for some garbage wins. You know, we know wins are unpredictable, but kind of garbage wins as they come. Joe Maddon in particular has not been shy about pulling Jason Hamill or John Lester tonight. He might have left him in a little bit too long. But he's been pulling guys and putting those pitchers in like Richard and Travis Wood, where they're, and Justin Grimm, who we can get to in a minute, where they're opportunities to win. So that's going to be my strategy the rest of the way, is to try to look for those relief opportunities. Not so much pushing for wins, because Vulture wins, your guess is as good as anyone else's. But just pitchers in multiple inning situations coming out of the bullpen. I like ex-starters. I like Richard because what they're doing with him is they're using him in situations where, you know, they still have a chance to win. And Joe Maddon, you know, if you've been paying attention, he's already managing the Cubs like it's the playoffs.
Yeah, which is great. I enjoy watching that.
Yeah, I you know, as Mets fans, Brett, I wish he were our manager.
He's like the anti-Matt Williams.
Yeah. but to your question, George, that's kind of what I'm looking at. And, you know, one thing about Tristan being behind me, you know, Brett and I talked about this too. The amazing thing about Tristan's run, this is the first time he's won Tout Wars for 3 years in a row. This is the first time that he's been in second place or lower, and he's in second place in August. He hasn't been below first place in those 3 years later than July 27th. Think about that. This is a league with really good owners. You know, we talk about Tristan a lot, but Steve Garner of USA Today is in this league. Phil Hertz is in this league. You know, I can rattle off everyone's in this league. There are some sharks in this league. And I like to think I'm pretty good too. But, you know, Tristan's just one of those people. He is amazing. And, you know, that's just a testament to how good he is, that from August to September for the last 3 years, this is the first year he hasn't been in first place.
It's really incredible.
So anyway, that was Tristan's strategy. Like I said, I grabbed, I kind of wish I had bid more on Grimm in particular. Phil Hertz got him for six, and it was moved down to Vicker with four. I had the second highest bid. Pedro Baez, who didn't do as well, was my second choice, and Steve Garner bid 7. Vickery also brought him down to 4. Other people are making those relief plays like right now. And to your point, George, I think this is where even teams that are out of it, Phil's still in it. I think Phil and Lenny Melnick have an outside chance at first, and they should treat it that way. You know, they shouldn't act like the season's over by any means. A 15-point lead in mid-August is certainly not insurmountable. A lot has to happen, but nothing's, you know, set in stone yet. But that's how teams are playing it, you know, to your point, George. They're looking at the categories and taking relievers over starters, depending on how things are shaking out for them.
Yeah, so do you want to let me talk about Grimm here for a minute?
I really do.
Okay, so I have an affinity for middle relievers, especially failed starters. I mean, if it is anything close to Wade Davis, the profile, I'm all over those guys. So Grimm, to me, I think is fascinating because you might remember him as a sort of a failed starter in Texas, and he goes over to the Cubs, and this year he's been outstanding. He missed the start of the year with an injury. Joe Maddon calls him his mid-game closer, basically the best guy that they have there in the middle innings, which is exactly what you're talking about, Mike. He's a guy with a lot of win vulture potential there. His best pitch, the power curve he has, he throws it at 85 miles an hour. And he pitched last night, and he struck out the side, all three batters on the power curve, including Miguel Cabrera and J.D. Martinez, who are pretty good. So he's throwing a lot harder. I mean, he's touched as high as 97, 98 in his last couple of outings. He's consistently 95 on the fastball. This year, he's allowed just 5 earned runs. That's a 1.30 earned run average. 13 strikeouts per 9, so that's 52 Ks in 34 and two-thirds innings. He's been really good, and I think these are the kind of guys where if you target them, yeah, they're not going to pitch a ton of innings, but especially in a league where there's a start limit every week, this is a guy who's really going to help you out. So I think he's flown under the radar, and he's a lot better than people realize.
You know, before you came to the show and when, you know, our guy behind the glass was Mal, you know, we talked about this in, you know, start leagues certainly, but in NL only and even in deeper mix. You know, last year in labor, you know, and he's an extreme example, but Brett and I had Betances. Middle relievers provide a lot of value, and particularly in only leagues, you're better off with a middle reliever with, you know, great ratios and, you know, strikeouts and then 11 to 12 batters per 9 innings, you know, as opposed to your fringy starter. That's changed a little bit because we're in an era of pitching, but it still applies with these top shelf middle relievers. And I absolutely agree, George. It's a great point. You know, a guy like Grimm is worth his weight in gold. You know, particularly if you can find a guy like that who's a convert, you know, somebody who's, you know, a couple ticks higher in velocity, you know, and someone who has had the experience now where his stuff is playing a little bit better than it had been in the past.
Grimm didn't start the year like exceptionally well. I mean, it probably took you a month or two, you know, watching him pitch to catch on. But these guys sort of crop up. I wouldn't go into my draft, you know, targeting middle relievers or anything like that. But there's going to be like Liam Hendricks and people like that.
Well, the thing about middle relievers, and this is even true in only formats, you don't really have to target them. You can get these guys for a buck. And, you know, one of the things I rail this about this in the expert only leagues every year, and, you know, I know we want to move on, we don't want to spend forever on this topic, but it's an interesting topic, is that the setups, the closers in waiting typically are the guys that go for $3 or $4. That's changed a little bit in tout the last couple of years. But you see these guys who simply because of the role and not be, you know, it's a whole skills over roles thing. I'm not necessarily a big believer in that, but I don't like the idea of paying $4 or $5 for a handcuff who may or may not, you know, be the closer. You know, he just happens to be the guy who's in the slot in April. You know, Aaron Barrett was probably a good example of that coming into the year. I'd rather pay $1 to, you know, in an auction format or take a guy in reserve who has those skills, who even if he isn't the closer, is going to go out there and, you know, put up like, you know, 70 or 80 strikeouts and 60 innings with the whip below 1 and the ERA before 2. And anything you get in wins and saves with a guy like that is gravy.
Grimm is good. The end. Grimm. That's all I got. Okay.
So I think the only other guys that I want to touch upon a little bit, and this will just tie a little bit in this, you know, some news from today. Andres Blanco went for two. I kind of shrugged at that bit at the time, but the combination of Michael Franco and a hairline fracture, and he may not be out for the year, but it sounds like the Phillies are going to be really cautious and just playing on the safe side. And then with the Chase Utley trade today, Blanco should get some at-bats, and you know, I don't think much of him, but in an only, he's fine. And I went and looked at the numbers. He's been surprisingly solid for the Phillies, which a lot of the Phillies' offense, that's the story right now. You look at them and you're like, really? Like, this guy is actually doing something that's worthwhile in an only? But yeah, Blanco in an only is okay. And then the other guy...
You've got to be kidding me.
What happened?
This has to be Mets-related.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, the Mets just gave up a game-winning home run to Henry Urrutia.
You hate that guy.
Come on.
Oh, well.
I think it's his first major league home run.
They did not deserve to win that game, quite honestly.
Urrutia got picked up in my like home dynasty league like 2 weeks ago, and I was like, why? Like, yeah, what?
He was picked up in Cowdale, too.
I don't really get it, but...
I don't know. Anyway, sorry. Anyway, that just sucks. All right, go ahead.
The other guy I wanted to talk about was John Lamb. He went for seven. That was on the Vickery. The raw bid was 15 to Peter Kreutzer. Peter's dead in every non-save category, so he probably picked him up to trade him. Lamb's yet another guy. I'm not enamored with him for this year, but I think long-term he could be okay. It's really hard with somebody like that to figure out, you know, what the trajectory is. Let's try that a third time. You know, coming off of the multiple injuries and the surgeries and what have you.
I kind of like John Lamb. I liked his first outing. There was the one bad inning, but I think he's relevant in an NL only. He's going to strike guys out.
Yeah, I really, when you're talking about deep mix and onlys, I really, really like this profile. The forgotten about former top prospect who has, you know, just kind of been lingering, and people have gotten all kinds of prospect fatigue on. I think there's something to be said about those guys being a little bit more, I don't know whether it's prepared or more, I guess feel slightly less pressure than some of the other guys that come up and make their debuts. I mean, Lamb was left for dead as a prospect. His velocity didn't come back after Tommy John for two consecutive seasons, and everyone wrote him off. And all of a sudden, he's back, and he's, you know, he always had the command profile to be a very strong starting pitcher. He's showing that now, just with a slightly lesser repertoire. And I think for a back end guy, I think it makes for someone who can step in right away and do some damage.
I think he's basically the left handed Mike Leake, like a little better. Like, I sort of see that as sort of where he is.
Solid. That's a solid comp.
Yeah.
Giving the caveat that we hate comps, so that's a solid comp.
Well, like, Mike Leake is relevant in NL only and deeper mixed, and that's kind of where Lamb's going to fit in, and he's going to have a starting job. Like, he's going to be in the rotation. They're not moving him out, so.
No, they definitely acquired him and Finnegan, you know, with them, you know, in mind for their future. I don't know if Finnegan will ever start, but Lamb definitely will, and he'll get opportunities. And, yeah, I shied away from him this week. You know, get back to the strategic points, George, because, you know, he's facing the Diamondbacks, who, you know, they didn't do well tonight, but they're hitting just about everybody now. And I believe that's in Cincinnati, and I just looked at that, and I didn't like that matchup at all.
Paul Goldschmidt is definitely hitting a home run in that game.
You would hope so. You know, it's funny, Goldschmidt has really, you know, if you look at him in the second half, he's really slumped in the power department. You know, a slump for Goldie is about a 900 OPS post-All-Star, but for him, that's down.
Should we talk about anybody in the AL? Or actually, I have one quick question before we move on away from the NL. Adam Wainwright got picked up for a buck.
Yep.
Give me your 5 second thought on this. Is it a worthwhile pickup at this point?
Probably not, but in the position that Brian's in, where he's trying to finish over the 60-point threshold, he has nothing to lose, and it's not bad.
I don't understand it. Doesn't make sense.
Okay. I like it. I get it, and I like it.
Okay. I don't know if that really offers any insight to anybody at the five-second rule, but okay.
Where does he sort of fit in role-wise?
I think it's starting to become more and more realistic that he could end up as a reliever the last 2 weeks of the season.
He's going to be a reliever. That's what I think. He's going to probably...
Absolutely, he's going to be a reliever.
Yeah.
The rookie, he's going to be in that role. He's going to be kind of a reliever that they, you know, try to stretch out as much as they possibly can for the playoffs.
Well, hang on, though. I mean, is he going to be in contention to... I mean, he's not going to close, so it's... I don't see him getting enough innings to really be a huge impact guy, even in an NL only. That's my only argument against it. Like... how many innings is he really going to throw in 2 weeks?
Yeah.
Are they even going to be good innings? Like,
You know, my problem with it, and this again is context. So Brian Walton, the Masters ball, he's, you know, let's see here. He's toward the bottom. He's got 49 points. He's trying to shoot for 60. I think between him and he also picked up Matt Adams for a buck, he's just trying to catch lightning in a bottle.
I mean, that's fair, but I mean, Archimedes Caminero is basically like going to be the same guy for that stretch. That's all. I mean, I get where Brett, you're right. I mean, it could, you know, be a huge deal, but I don't know.
But I think if
he's healthy, I think they're going to get him in high leverage positions pretty much right away.
But you get to the to get back to your point. You know, Caminero is actually owned, and Brian owns him in only. You know, the guys you're looking at, you know, Grim and Baez are probably the better guys that are typically out there from week to week. And this may have been a good week for the types of relievers that are available. I don't think it will work. I think in an NL only, though, I don't see the harm in trying it, particularly if you're in the position where you're trying to catch that magic for a couple weeks and, you know, hopefully get the absolute upside of Adam Wainwright as a reliever.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a buck. Who cares?
Good point.
I like it because I want to see Adam Wainwright come back.
So yeah. Let's see. AL only. We just mentioned Arusha. He was picked up for six. Lord Michaels got him for nine. The next second highest bid was five. It looks like he's going to play. I don't really think much of him either.
How old is he?
28.
28. Yikes. That's old.
It is old.
Well, it's old for a guy at Norfolk who...
Those are my five-second thoughts.
Are we going to do 5 seconds with all these guys? That would be quick.
He's pretty old. There.
Chris Johnson, also for six with Vickery. Are we doing 5 seconds here?
Oh, I didn't know we were continuing that.
Those are your 5 seconds, Mike. You're done.
Chris Johnson is fine. He should be owned in an AL-only league.
He's on the DL with a spider bite, but I think that happened after the bid.
Is he really?
Yeah.
Oh God.
Spiders are scary. Stay away.
I've heard of snake bit, but not spider bit. Nick Tropiano, who I think I like better than just about anybody else, and he also went for six with Vickery. I like him as the park in the defense. So he is what he is, but I think he has enough deception and, you know, enough going off of that change in a park that favors, you know, fly ball pitchers where, you know, he'll be okay.
I'm surprised he reserved Jesse Chavez, though. He actually pitched well today against, I think it was the Dodgers, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, I should point out when I put those together that's the actual move that goes into the system. It may very well be that afterward he gets activated again. I don't know, and honestly, I'm not inclined to spend another hour looking at it.
Okay, I didn't know.
No offense. I added that feature at some point because someone's like, hey, why don't you add who was reserved or who was cut? And I'm like, okay. But, I don't know. Who picked him up? Was that Wolf and Colton? Yeah, right now, Chris Liss, who picked up Franklin Gutierrez for four, you know, Chris is... he's not running away with it exactly because the categories are more dynamic than they are in the NL. But the last I looked, he had like an 11 or 12-point lead.
Yeah, I don't think Matt Shoemaker is coming back anytime soon.
No, I think it Tropiano has a shot at least to hold on to the job.
Yeah, I mean, I just I I dropped Shoemaker in a 20-team mixed. I don't think there's any point.
He's a guy I was wrong about in the sense that I thought he'd be adequate, and he most certainly has not been.
And so, if you look at last year, a lot of his fantasy value, I mean, Mike, you do the valuations, but, I mean, those 16 wins, that drove a lot of his value.
Yeah, wins drive the bus a lot on value, and, you know, that's definitely a case where, you know, but Shoemaker was someone who I thought, similar to Tropiano, I thought he'd survive. I didn't think he'd be great. I thought he'd survive based on the park, you know, based on fly ball tendencies in that park. I thought he put up like a high three. He was just bad.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way around it.
Five second thoughts. Matt Shoemaker, bad. Nick Tropiano, potentially better.
Potentially, but probably bad.
I'll just say yes.
Okay.
That's and fair. Then the other guy I'll mention, the AL, is Franklin Gutierrez, who I think everybody wishes would stay healthy. And I was surprised to see his ISO when I wrote the article was over 300. You know, he's 7 home runs and a ridiculously low amount of plate appearances. We know it won't last. You know, the thing about Gutierrez at AL only, I think, is sneaky. He's on the bad side of a platoon, but he's platooning with Seth Smith, who hasn't done very well or done much. It's not hard to see Gutierrez muscling his way into more of that job. I still wouldn't take him in anything past AL only at this point, but he is producing.
Yeah, it's a nice story, and I agree that I would like to see him stay healthy, but I don't expect the power surge to even remotely continue.
Yep. I mean, no, you know, nobody can keep that level of power up. That would be ridiculous.
Yeah. But even a regressed version of this, I still don't think is
hitting like on a Kyle Schwarber, Miguel Sano level, and, you know, or close to it in terms of the ISO. And we know those guys are not going to continue hitting that way. So, you know, we definitely don't believe Gutierrez will either. You know,
what if he was bitten by a radioactive spider and now has superhuman strength?
Well, in that case, it would be very possible.
Don't rule it out. I've totally gone off the rails here. My bad.
Well, now you're making cultural references that we all understand, so that's nice.
Okay, that's good. All right, we did way too long here on the Fab, I think.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, we can move to... Sorry about that.
That's what we're known for.
We can move to trades or our next topic.
Okay, so what we're going to talk about a little bit is there... You know, in redraft leagues, a lot of trade deadlines are coming up over the next week or two, and I think it's important to check in on some of the main tenets of late season trading, and what really thought process should be that goes into it. What are the things that you should be considering, and so forth. So. I want to throw it back to Mike because I want to use that. There's been some I know Tout's relatively quiet in trades, but I want to kind of use that as a jumping off point in talking about this. I'm sure you've seen late season trades. I don't know if there's been a whole lot of activity recently, but. What are some good examples of trades that you've seen that are type of trades that would be made in August but probably wouldn't be made in June?
Well, typically what happens, well, there's a couple types of trades that happen in Tout. You know, and because the race is close, this year overall, you're right, has been kind of tight. There haven't been a lot of trades in general. I recently traded Addison Russell and Jeremy Hellickson for Shelby Miller. I had some offensive excess with David Wright coming back. It looks like next week now, I can, and being first in home runs and runs batted, and I could take a little bit of a hit. You know, I looked at Miller. You know, even Hellickson goes out and does relatively well. I look at Miller as more of a sure thing. So that's kind of the first trade you have. You have teams that have an excess in a category, trading from that excess and trading to another team. I was honestly surprised that Phil Hertz of Baseball HQ took Russell. Not that I like Russell, But at one point he was asking for Lucas Duda right before Duda had his back problems, and I thought, yeah, you know, in an OBP league, that's a little much. So that's the first type of trade you see, is a team at or near the top trading from excess in categories. But the second thing you see, and I think we'll see this as we get really close to the deadline, you'll see a team, and I think Peter Kreutzer, who's very innovative, will try to do this in this league. He's at the bottom in the pitching categories. He'll probably take any pitcher he has and trade that pitcher for 50 cents on the dollar for any upgrade he can get anywhere else. You know, so if he has a pitcher who's providing any value at all because he's already drawing dead in those categories, I mentioned John Lamb, who he fabbed. If Lamb has, you know, two or three good starts between now and the deadline, he'll flip Lamb for whatever he can get. So those are the types of trades you see in an expert redraft. You see trades for teams that are going for it and trying to win and trying to maximize their categories. And then you see trades from teams at the bottom that are trying to hit that 60-point threshold so they don't get the fab penalty. And I you know, I did that one year. You know, I think it was last year I was out of it, and I was trying to stay above that threshold. I traded for a bunch of closers because I knew I could gain a lot of points and saves. And I moved players in categories where it was like, yeah, you know, I might lose a point or two, but honestly, I'm already doing badly in these categories. It won't really matter.
Yeah, it's I like to call that a flailing trade, where where you just kind of you try to soak up every piece of value you have in one particular area and turn it into value in an area that's more helpful.
Can I ask you a question now? Tout is unique because of the FAB penalty, teams are encouraged to trade even if they're at the bottom. Like, for example, Todd Zola, as I'm looking at the standings now, is in last place. He has 48.5 points. He'll lose $12 in FAB next year if that's where he finishes. You know, and obviously you don't want to start the year with $88 in FAB as opposed to 100. So Todd is going to try his hardest to get to 60. You know, he might not get there, but he's going to, you know, try to get to 50, 55, whatever. If you're in an expert league that doesn't have a penalty for the next year, do you think there's an imperative not to trade if it impacts the league? Or do you feel that, well, you know, if I can finish 10th or 9th as opposed to like 14th, I should try to do that?
Yeah, I think every team has an imperative to finish the season as strongly as they can. And a lot of leagues have, you know, if it's not a FAB penalty, a lot of leagues have second half prizes, or, you know, but my home league that I play in has both a second half prize and a post trade deadline prize. So the most improved team after each checkpoint gets a small prize, but not a insignificant one. So you see teams at the bottom doing a lot, making a lot of movement, which I think is really good. I mean, you don't want a league where, you know, the bottom, you know, 2/3 of the teams are just kind of coasting through the last 2 months and barely even paying attention. That's no fun.
Right.
You want those teams in there competing, and you want to have those additional trade partners. Even if you're, you know, even if you're a top team and you get a little annoyed because the 8th, 9th place teams are outbidding you on the waiver wire for guys that you want, those are teams that are going to be active trade partners coming down the stretch. So
yeah,
it balances itself out in different ways. I think having a little bit of a carrot for people to pay attention in redrafts is a great thing, and I strongly encourage it.
The one thing I would say is that if you're in a league, the one thing I would discourage in terms of moves is if you're in a league where a team's out of it, you don't want a team, and this is less to do with trading, you don't want a team picking off players that they're clearly not going to keep next year. That's the one thing I kind of advise against if you're setting up rules. So, you know, if you're in a situation where, you know, someone claimed past a certain date or someone fabbed over a certain price clearly isn't a keeper, that's where I get a little bit wary and I want to be careful. But otherwise, I definitely agree. I prefer setups where everybody has something to play for, even if it's, you know, like you're saying, Brett, a little bit of money at the end of the year or a second half prize. That's much better than a situation where, you know, half the league isn't even paying attention. Just like, I don't care anymore.
I mean, that is part of the appeal of a dynasty league. I have one league, a home league, where my team is just terrible this year, rebuilding. But it's like I'm still making tons of moves. I'm trying to make trades. I'm looking to build, you know, future pieces. It actually is helpful to work with the contending teams because you might have something that helps them win now, and you can get a piece for the future. So, yeah.
Well, something in the lower profile expert leagues. I'm not talking about labor or tout, but you know, we get invited to mocks, and you know, George, I don't know if you do baseball mocks in February, but Brett and I get invited to mocks, and we do them. But then there are also leagues that carry through, and mm-hmm. some of these leagues are not quite as renowned. And what winds up happening is half the owners in the league stop paying attention because it's a redraft, and it serves to advantage the teams at the top, where, say, if they're middle of the pack in a category, they can move up. And you wind up getting penalized if you're at the top in a category because teams wind up catching you or getting closer to you because those teams way at the bottom aren't paying attention.
Yeah, you definitely do see that.
I hate that. But we've kind of moved away from the trading topic a little bit, so... You know, beyond those two types of trades in a redraft, I don't know if there was something else that you wanted to talk about, Brett, or there's some other topic that interested you.
Yeah, I think it's really more the concept of how in August trades sort of valuations don't go completely out the window, but valuations become much less important and positions become much more important and projections and really knowing what your team needs, knowing what your team is capable of, the team that you currently have. You get to a point where, you know, you could have someone ranked as the 50th best player in fantasy, and you could trade them for a player that you think is the 100th ranked player in fantasy, and it could make total sense in August, where you would never make that trade in May or June because at the beginning of the season you're still trying to accumulate as much value as possible over the course of the remaining 4 or 5 months.
Yeah, there's that, and the other element in May is that as much as you might think you have a handle on your team, so much can change. Like my Tau team, I really thought the pitching was good, and then Doug Fister was terrible, and Andrew Kasher has been well below subpar. So I've needed pitching more than I've needed hitting. So, to make a trade in May or even in April, it's like, oh, my pitching's great. I'm going to trade a pitcher for a hitter. That wouldn't have made sense at all. Sometimes it pays to wait out, circumstances and to see how things actually play out as opposed to looking at the projections and saying, well, my team's going to win. The other problem with projections, as we know, any expert worth their salt is going to do well using their own projection system. Like if you, we joke about this in March, like if you don't think you have a top two or three team with your projection system, you probably should stop doing this because you're not very good at constructing a team. It's true. Think about it. If you're like, well, my projection system isn't going to finish in ninth. It's like, well, you don't know how to auction, you don't know how to draft because you're drafting off of your projections.
Something went wrong. Yeah. But I mean, to go off of the general point we have for as far as like trade targets go, I think you guys sort of hit the nail on the head where early in the year you might be taking chances on guys where they've gotten off to a slow start and you're looking at them turning it around and you're making sort of the long play. I think if you look at splits after the All-Star break, and maybe you move a guy who you believed in 3 months ago for someone who's been hot over the last 6 weeks or something like that. I think that stuff matters more now than I'm trying to think of a good example like this. Maybe like a guy like Victor Martinez. Like if you thought Martinez was eventually going to get healthy and that, with rest and maybe a DL stint, he was going to come back and be fine. Maybe you made a trade for him, a couple of months ago. Now I would totally deal him for someone like, I don't know, like Mitch Moreland, if you could get that, like something like that is kind of what I'm thinking, where you have to pay more attention to, not necessarily, like you said, the long-term outlook, but really the short-term right now, the impact you're going to get.
Yeah, and there are some really good examples of that. I mean, you guys like, I still like Trevor Bauer from a long-term perspective.
Right.
But, I mean, if I have him in a redraft league, I'm pretty much trying to trade him for whatever at this point, whatever can help me, because he's, you know, it doesn't seem like this is going to be the year that he quite figures it out. And I'm not confident about his, you know, performance over the last, you know, 6-7 weeks of this season.
Yeah, like I would trade him for someone like R.A. Dickey, who for some reason is on a roll right now, and I take the shot that he keeps it going here over the final month, over, you know, betting on Bauer all of a sudden figuring it out here.
Yeah, I probably would do that too.
Right, that's the kind of deal I was sort of thinking. I didn't spend like any time thinking about it, you know, obviously off the top of my head, but that's the recent performance matters more.
Deal him for Justin Verlander.
I mean, Bauer's not been good lately.
Yeah.
I think you have to consider that type of stuff. Yep. Especially on the pitching side.
Yeah. And as I mentioned before, on the pitch, I can't emphasize this enough. When you're dealing for a pitcher this late in the season, you have to look at his schedule. You really do, because you have unbalanced schedules at this point. You know, we don't need to tell you how advantageous pitching in the NL East is this time of year. And if a, you know, pitcher in the NL West has, you know, a starter, who knows? There could be pitchers on the Giants or Dodgers that have two starts in Coors the rest of the way. And if you're dealing for a guy who has 8 starts left and it looks like 2 of them are going to come in Coors, that's a huge value hit. You really have to be cognizant of what these players are going up against the rest of the way, just to avoid situations that you don't expect to get yourself into.
And the other thing I'd point out with the matchups, and we alluded to this before, is the pitchers who are going to have starts skipped, or, you know, the Mets are in a position where, you know, they mentioned, you know, and it may work to his advantage. You know, Matt Harvey looks like he's going to be skipped in Colorado, which would be a good thing. But he's still going to lose a start. But there's pitchers like Aaron Nola, who it sounds like the Phillies are going to go with a 6-man. They're going to promote that one of the pitchers they acquired from Texas, it sounds like, in the next week or two. And if you have Nola, you have to kind of discount a start or two from him that you may have gotten. So all these things are things to consider. And we've kind of broadened this past trades. But, you know, if you're making a trade, these are definitely things you want to look at. There's some value to the schedule. There's also value to the certainty with a veteran starter that he's going to take his turn, go out there every fifth day, as opposed to somebody, you know, even like a Noah Syndergaard, who there's a good chance Noah Syndergaard is going to have a start or two skipped. And the Mets are in a weird position. I think it was Mike Vicar of the New York Post wrote about this today. The Mets are in a weird position where they're in contention, but they still want to watch those innings. So if you have Syndergaard, if you have Harvey, you might not get the 8 starts you'd get from another pitcher. You might get 6, you might get 7. It's granular, but it's the kind of thing, if you're in a tight league, you really, and I, you know, I'm disagreeing with you, Brett, emphatically, you really have to look at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't see the Mets doing that with DeGrom, though.
I really doubt it. What I could see with DeGrom is that if they somehow win it, you know, if they're up by 5 or 6 and they clinch, you know, I hate saying some Mets fans, I feel like I'm going to, you know, ruin it all because of 2007 and the bad memories. But if they somehow clinch, you know, a week or under a week out, I could see them just skipping DeGrom for that last start and then setting him up for the playoffs. Yeah, beyond that, it's hard to see them skipping him entirely. I could see them pushing him back, maybe. I can't see them skipping him.
Yeah. No, I mean, we'll see, but.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, I have no inside information. I'm just guessing based on what I would anticipate.
I actually wrote about DeGrom this week, so
you did. Everyone
should check that out. It's a fun piece. Actually, I had one interesting conversation with one of our colleagues over at BP, and his concerns more are long term with DeGrom in terms of the velocity spike and that he's had Tommy John before. Is that any sort of a concern in the back of either of your guys' minds watching him pitch, that at some point this could fall apart? Or because I don't have those at all, and I haven't really heard that a whole lot. So I just want to get your thoughts on that.
I'd be lying if I said it wasn't way in the back of my head.
Right.
But You know, it's not really, it's been a, I think a velocity spike is not a fair way to describe it, and which is why I'm not that concerned. It's been a very gradual velocity increase. He didn't just show up one season with a 3-mile-an-hour spike on his fastball. His fastball has just slowly been ticking up pretty much every start for the last 2.5 years.
Yeah,
it's really kind of scary. You don't see that very often, but it's this is a biomechanical question that I definitely can't answer, but I wonder whether the gradual ramp up of his velocity makes him less of an injury risk than someone who sees the same sort of year or 2 year velocity increase, but sees it all at once.
Yeah, see, I just think DeGrom's gradually getting better. I think we're seeing improvement, so it doesn't strike me as anything out of the ordinary. I mean, it's freaky how he's just continued to get better. It's like scary.
I'm inclined to agree. And like Brett, I don't want to put myself, in a position of being a biomechanical or a medical expert, but anecdotally, it does seem to me that pitchers who are converted pitchers who start a little bit later have a little bit more life in their arms as opposed to somebody who's been pitching since he was like 16 or 17. Brett, when you go over to Tino this week, assuming you're having, you're doing Tino this week, you can have that conversation as well and maybe harken back to some converted pitchers. Something I think about, analogously is I think about catchers who kind of started out late, like Russell Martin or, back when he was playing Jorge Posada. Different, things going on there. But I think the conversion in terms of a catcher, it saves them in terms of the wear and tear, on crouching and the innings and the life on their knees. I think in terms of pitchers, it does save them a little bit because they're not throwing from the time they're, some of these guys are throwing from the time like 10 or 12. It's certainly not the same intensity, but, you go to high school, you go to college, you go to the minors. George, I saw the conversation you were having. I forget who it was with, but
It was JJ Jansen. Sorry,
it was JJ. Yeah, okay. I wasn't sure it was JJ or Matthew Trueblood, because Matthew's the one who sometimes will jump in and get into lively conversations.
JJ, I mean, he's really smart and he knows his stuff. So it was like a splitting hairs sort of argument. It's like, well, what's the difference between him being the number two guy and the number six guy or something like that? It's just something that you got to keep in mind.
When we get into our September topics, and we start pairing, looking at rankings, that could be really interesting. But for now, I look at DeGrom and, he's an injury risk or a risk as much as any pitcher's a risk. If I had to rank him for next year, he's definitely in consideration for pitchers as a top five.
Yeah, we talked about this and we talked about this on Tino last week, and I think three out of the four of us had DeGrom as the number two starter in dynasty leagues right now.
In dynasty,
yeah, but I would have right now. If I was drafting a 2016 team right now, he's my number two starting pitcher off the board behind Kershaw.
Yeah, between the ERA and the strikeouts, it's top 10 in both. I mean, he gives you so much, and he's basically been the exact same guy for 2 years.
I mean, it's really tough because, I said top five, and I'm thinking about, Kershaw, he's definitely behind. The other guys you put into consideration to go behind are Max Scherzer and Zach Greinke, and, if Greinke opts out and winds up in the AL...
Honestly, Greinke's not even in consideration for me. I don't think I have Greinke in the top five. I have Sale ahead of Greinke.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I wrote about. I mean, you can make the argument for Scherzer and Sale, but those are the only two guys I really see that you could really make a big case. Because Greinke, it's the ERA. I mean,
who is in the minority in Tino? Because I have a feeling I'm, and crossing the streams here, I'm agreeing with that person. And again, this is granular. But
I don't remember.
I might have Scherzer ahead of DeGrom just for 16.
Well, we weren't talking about just for 16. We were talking about in dynasty.
Oh yeah, you guys are in dynasty, which is, I understand, it's a whole different animal.
Yeah, see, I think Brett and I are on the same page. I would put DeGrom 2 for both 16 and in dynasty.
Yeah, Yeah, yeah. I might have to Grom 3 or 4.
It's close, but.
Well, we put our composite rankings next year, Brett. We can disagree about DeGrom, and hopefully the composites work out as well for us, you know, in 2016 as they have so far this year.
This could be a fun debate. I know that.
Looking back at Labor, speaking of debates, you know, I got into a long discussion with, I think it was Gray Albright of Razzball, and if it was Rudy, actually, it might have been Rudy. It was one of them. I always apologize because I think it was Rudy, because Rudy has the Oscar Gamble logo, so it was Rudy. And we were talking about pitching and where to draft it. And, you know, we've talked about this on the show, Brett, about, you know, taking Kershaw early versus not early. And, you know, I made the point of where we got our pitchers when we got them. And he's kind of like, well, that's lucky. I'm like, well, yeah, it was lucky. But the point is you had three pitchers in Jake Arrieta, Gerrit Cole, and Jacob deGrom who went as late as they did. And the argument isn't that you necessarily can get those, you know, those guys – all those guys, that you can get one of those guys late and can change the composition of your staff. So what I kind of wonder about DeGrom is that whether he does this or not next year, I'm more curious as to who the 2016 DeGrom is going to be. Like that guy who in the ninth round of a 15-team mix, you know, is sitting there.
Do you want to everyone give a name? Because I have one in mind.
I'm terrible at this, but
I'd say Marcus Stroman.
Yeah, he might go later than that, too.
Right. I think he's that good, though.
Oh, I do too. If the health is there, yeah.
Yeah. Brett,
Are we all giving names now?
Oh, I'll give a name if we're playing this game. I'll give a name.
Stroman was the easy answer, I think.
Yeah, I don't know if Stroman quite fits though, because Stroman wasn't healthy, so he's there for injury reasons.
He was a $3 pitcher in AL only, which puts him pretty high, you know, in the mixed pantheon.
Yeah, so we're talking about a guy who's pitched well this year that we think is going to kind of do it again. Okay, that's fair.
Who wants to go first?
Well, I think my problem with this exercise, like the guy I was thinking about, somebody was talking about before, you know, I was thinking Noah Syndergaard, but he might go higher than the ninth round.
Well, maybe. You know, the guy who jumps into my mind who might go around then next year is Carlos Carrasco.
Yeah, that's who I was actually thinking.
Carrasco is going to get Carrasco. His raw stats are not great.
Yeah,
he's going to get overshadowed a little bit but the underlying numbers I think will make him a little overshadowed by Danny Salazar, and I like him a lot better than Danny Salazar. I think Carrasco could be like an eighth, ninth round guy next year, maybe, and I think he could be. I think he has the upside to be a top five starter.
Would you put Carlos Martinez in that category? In terms of he probably won't go before the fifth round.
No, I don't think he quite has that upside. I really like Carlos Martinez. I don't see him being a top 10 starter unless the bulk of that value comes in wins.
Okay. Yeah, actually the guy who I was thinking of was Carrasco, because yeah. I wrote about him like a month ago, and he just has had like a weird year in terms of the defense behind him early was just absolutely terrible, but the strikeout numbers have been there, and sort of the underlying advanced stats and deserve run average and everything like that have backed up that he's pitched like an elite guy, basically.
Look at you using deserved run average.
I know.
I literally have it bookmarked when I open my computer.
I've started relying on that or looking at that more and more. It's a very good metric, and you know, I'm hoping once we get to the off season, I can really dive in and you know send even more questions to Harry Pavlidis about that.
Yeah.
You know, to come full circle, if he was going, I mean, he's not going to be drafted this high. I was going to say Raisel Iglesias.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he won't go. He won't go ninth.
No,
Well, that's the other. You know, that's the other funny thing. You know, looking at pitchers. You know, I mentioned Syndergaard. You know, we got Syndergaard and Andrew Haney on, you know, reserve in a deep mix. You know, those are the guys, and I can't name them now. You know, don't make me try to do it. That's a better topic for Tino. But those are the guys I'm really curious about. Like, you know, the guys next year that will potentially be under the radar who could. It's not sitting or Haney under the radar. I think Haney more so because people were kind of down on him and all that. But, you know, the guys that people are going to look at and be like, well, they won't be up in 2016 or they'll be up late, but then they'll be up earlier than you expect and they'll provide more value than expected.
Yep. There's always those guys.
to, you know, one more trade point. So I'm in an old school home league. I've talked about it on the show, not so much with you, George, but the league is older than you are, George. I haven't been in it that long, but it's older than you are. And it's an old school 4x4, ale only. We have an old school rule. It's a contiguous trade rule. So in the month of August, you can only trade with the team ahead of you and below you in the standings. It's an anti-dump rule. So the idea is that, you know, the team in first on August 31st can't, you know, annihilate the team in 12th and change the composition of the league and, you know, make people want to quit or get mad. But it adds an extra wrinkle of strategy, because what winds up happening is you ultimately have that trade between the fifth place and the sixth place team, or the fourth place and the fifth place team, where somebody's like, yeah, I'm going to go for it. You know, and I know it's crazy, but I've already kind of mostly, you know, I'm mostly in the water or mostly in the pool anyway. So I might as well just completely empty the, you know, the shelf. And the guy in fifth who was going for it was like, yeah, this isn't really working out. I'm going to just give up and trade everything. And you wind up with some of the most lopsided trades that don't do the team that's trying to go for it very much good anyway.
That's like kind of ironic. But
it's just a weird, well, it's always a weird decision point. And I know, you know, what rarely happens, it's rare that the teams in first and second place make a trade, because they're competing and they're like, yeah, I don't want to help that guy out, or I don't want to help that, whether it's redraft or whether it's a carryover, that's probably the most universal thing. Nobody wants to make that trade with the team in first that puts them over the top. Like, nobody ever wants to do it.
Very true. So, yeah, I think that was a good conversation.
I think it was too. And I think we, as we often do, we spent more time on here than we thought we would. Although we won't be hearing our voices for another 2 weeks, so maybe that's fine.
This is true. So this is the time of year where we shift the podcast from weekly to biweekly. Just because from the trade deadline to ranking season, there's much less to talk about, and we certainly don't want to stop doing the podcast entirely. So going every other week allows us to stay a little fresher in topics. So
Schwarber just hit a home run, by the way.
Oh, hell yeah.
Guy's a stud.
Oh, yeah.
Wait, did he or yes?
No, he did.
This is your I'm happy, but Tristan has him reaction.
Yeah, Tristan's
great for Tristan and in town. It's great for us in labor, and yeah.
Yeah.
So do you take Trout after Schwarber, or how do you view that next year?
that's a question for another day of where Schwarber, you know, with he should have catcher eligibility, I think, you know, where
he will, yeah.
He obviously will not land ahead of Trout, though. I think that's a pretty safe assumption.
That's more of a topic for Tino, I guess. But, like, how high Schwarber should actually rank next year, or, like, going forward.
It's going to be a fun debate in all formats.
He's crazy, crazy good.
Yep.
All right.
But we'll take a quick break, and we'll come back and wrap things up. Thank you for listening to episode 65 of Flags Fly Forever. We have been a baseball prospectus fantasy podcast. You've been listening to me, Brett Sayer, and Mike Gianella, and George Bissell. Read all of us at baseballprospectus.com. Come subscribe today. Premium membership gets you access to all of our awesome content, fantasy and otherwise. Super premium membership gets you access to all of that, plus the Bat Signal, which is our fantasy answering service, which comes in handy every time of year, but especially around trade deadline season when people are trying to tweak their teams a little bit. Send us a question, we'll answer it generally within about 12 hours, and everything is nice and private so that your league mates won't see it. Other than that, we will be back in September, right? Yeah, we'll be back in September. And we will see you guys then. Email us, flagsflyforeverbaseballprospectus.com. We will see you later. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Later, Carswell. References.
You know Horshack, do you know who Horshack is?
No.
Oh, fuck everything.
Who is it? What is that from?
There's a show called Welcome Back Cotter, which was
I'm gonna do the outro before we kill each other.